Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as a world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to this special bonus edition of the NewsHour podcast. I'm James Menendez. And now, as you're probably aware, NewsHour has been on the road in the United States ahead of what's sure to be one of the most dramatic presidential elections in recent memory. So far, it's been a campaign in which a sitting president has dropped out of the race for the first time in over half a century, and one in which a former president convicted on criminal charges has escaped an assassin's bullet, and it seems another attempt on his life. In essence, it feels as if anything could happen. Well, Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, looked at one stage like he'd taken an unassailable lead in the polls.
We will have an incredible victory, and we will begin the four greatest years in the history of our country.
But after Joe Biden dropped out and Kamala Harris replaced him, the Democrats drew neck and neck.
We're not going back. It's time to turn the page, to stand for country, to stand for our democracy, to stand for rule of law.
Well, in this special podcast extra, we'll be speaking to Midwesterners who suddenly find themselves center stage in the election.
I'm very excited to be a part of Swing State. I feel like I have an important role in trying to get all of my friends and extended family members to vote and be a part of the democratic process.
We'll head to Georgia to focus on the people who haven't yet decided how they'll vote.
Some percentage of this undecided may not even turn out to vote, period. And so both campaigns are attempting, to the extent possible, to mobilize their supporters right now. I mean, that's really the phase we're in right now.
And while some people are wondering what's going to happen in the next 40 days, we'll hear from the survivalists in Oregon preparing for a once in 300 years natural disaster. All that is coming up on this NewsHour special podcast on the American elections from the BBC World Service. Well, I've been in St. Louis, Missouri, home to the soaring steel of the city's famous arch, the Gateway to the West. Missouri is Midwest territory, a region that's often overlooked, even derided, but one that's having quite a moment in this year's election. It contains two crucial swing states, Michigan and Wisconsin, and it claims both vice presidential picks. Kamala Harris chose as her running mate the folksy governor of Minnesota, Tim Walz.
Minnesota's strength comes from our values, our commitment to working together, to seeing past our differences, to always being willing to lend a helping hand. Those are the same values I learned on the family farm and tried to instill in my students.
Donald Trump went for the punchy Ohio Senator J.D. Vance.
I grew up in Middletown, Ohio, a small town where people spoke their minds, built with their hands, and loved their God, their family, their community, and their country with their whole hearts.
But what is a Midwesterner? I headed to the beautiful campus of Washington University in St. Louis to gauge the opinion of some of the students there. I asked Evangeline Joyce, a second year from Wisconsin, what it meant to be a Midwesterner.
It means kind of leaning into the stereotypes. We have a lot of stereotypes about, like, we're...
Tell me what they are. Yeah. I don't know what they are.
Well, Wisconsin at first is, we're cheeseheads. Everyone calls us that, which some people don't like it, but I think it's a fun thing that we can lean into. And everyone talks about the Midwest being really nice and polite. And I think that that's a good stereotype to have, and that maybe the East Coast and the West Coast could take a page out of our book.
Because they're not nice.
Sometimes. I don't know. But, I think being a Midwesterner is just having a great sense of community and hard work, and it's nice to identify with so many people from different states and that we all share these collective values.
Okay, if you can just introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Emma Feldmeyer. I'm a sophomore at WashU majoring in political science.
And where are you from?
I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio.
So, same question. What does being a Midwesterner mean to you? I mean, is there such a thing as a Midwesterner, do you think?
Yes and no. I think we share some commonalities with some other regions of the country, but I also think there are some distinctions. We do have a very strong sense of community. Contrary to popular opinion, we're actually fairly diverse.
Now, you're from Wisconsin.
Yes.
And that is a big, big swing state. And in fact, I was reading today that someone saying, you know, the problem with living in Wisconsin is you just get bombarded with kind of people calling up, asking which way you're going to vote, you know, mail shots and the rest of it. I mean, do you feel when you're in Wisconsin that you're kind of suddenly all the attention's on you politically when it is a big election year?
I have been feeling that, yes. And we've had a lot of like rallies concentrated in Wisconsin as well. I personally went to Kamala Harris and Tim Walz rally like a couple weeks before I came to school. And that was really exciting. I love seeing Wisconsin be a big part of the political spectrum, because it's interesting that, as you were saying, like the Midwest is sometimes in the background of the U.S. and it's nice to kind of come to the forefront. But
yeah, I mean, there's a serious point here, which is that actually people, you know, if they're just trying to get votes, they're taking the place seriously and potentially doing something for Wisconsin, for example, right?
Yes, that's true. I think. But I'm very excited to be a part of Swing State, and I feel like I have an important role in trying to get all of my friends and extended family members to vote and be a part of the democratic process.
I mean, would you go along with what you've been hearing? I mean, is it nice to feel like you're, you know, the Midwest is the center of attention? I mean, which it is.
Yeah, it is really nice. And I think something special about the Midwest is we have a lot of swing states, and so our votes like matter a decent amount. Obviously in Ohio that's become less true as we've gotten more red, but I think it's definitely important for people to feel empowered in a region where they normally don't feel as empowered, because the attention isn't really on the Midwest as much. So I think it's a good change of pace when an election comes up and people feel like their voices are heard.
And of course, you know, this region has had a really important role in building the American economy. And some would say that is continuing. But I mean, there are places, of course, where that's declined. I mean, do you think that the Midwest has a bright future ahead of it?
Yeah, I do. I feel like, I don't know, with this election, it can go either way. So it very much depends. Like, we have two very diametrically opposed options, and we definitely have a lot of potential, especially with working class. I feel like people definitely are very hardworking and invested in our society.
I mean, from a professional point of view, after you leave university, can you see your future career somewhere around here? Or are you going to go to the coast, go to LA or New York?
Too early to tell, but I definitely would love to stay in the Midwest, because it just has like a really homey feeling. And I think it's helpful being in places like St. Louis and Cincinnati, where I do feel a sense of community politically, because they're both like Democrat leaning cities. And
but are there opportunities though, do you think? I mean, are there jobs?
I think there are, yes. I had like a local job this summer, and I saw that even though like the state of Ohio isn't where I'm affiliated with, like locally there are a lot of opportunities, and that'll be true in any state, including in Missouri, St. Louis, a lot of good opportunities.
And that was Emma Feldmeyer speaking with some of her fellow students at Washington University. If this election is tight, and the opinion polls suggest it will be, then some states will matter much, much more than others. The swing states, the ones which in recent years have flickered between red and blue, Republican and Democrat. Georgia is one of those, with its 16 electoral votes in the race to get to the magical figure of 270 to secure the keys to the White House. My colleague Tim Franks has just visited the state, partly to search for the swing voter. But how many of those really exist? Surely pretty much everyone's made up their mind about the candidates, particularly given how familiar Donald Trump is. Earlier this month, though, the New York Times had a report suggesting that nationwide, 18% of voters counted as swing. Could that really be the case? Well, Tim's been speaking to the professor of political science at the University of Georgia, Trey Hood.
In a state like Georgia, where the presidential election was decided in 2020 by less than 12,000 votes, it wouldn't take that percentage, you know. I mean, and there are a certain number of people, a certain percentage, that are just tuned out. They're not going to tune in till right before the election. I mean, yes, they know who Trump is. They probably know who Harris is. But they're not still not really tuned in. You know, since Biden has dropped out of the race and Harris has been put in as the Democratic nominee, I had Georgia as lean Republican before then, and now I've had to put it back into the toss-up category. It's not going to take much either way for Georgia to be flipped one way or the other.
What do you think is likely then? Is it just a matter of proximity to the election, that as we get closer to the election, those people who maybe haven't made up their minds will begin to tune in? Or do you think actually it's the sort of thing where there are certain things that both parties, both candidates could do to try and make the weather, try and grab people's attention, try and persuade people?
Well, they're going to try to, you know, and again, some percentage of this undecided may not even turn out to vote, period. And so both campaigns are attempting to the extent possible to mobilize their supporters right now. I mean, that's really the phase we're in right now.
Yeah, is get the base out.
Right.
Yeah. And in terms of Georgia, do you think that the key issues here are sort of pretty much the key issues that we see around the country? Or do you think there are certain things that are particularly emphasized here in Georgia that people do have particular concerns about?
I think we're not that much different in the presidential election in terms of issues that people think are important, you know, especially the economy, inflation, cost of living. Those kinds of things are very much on people's minds because that's something that affects them every day when they go to the grocery store or the gas pump here. Immigration is a big issue, even though we're not right on the border. There's some people thinking about that. So I don't think we're all that much different from other states right now in some of those regards.
Obviously, Georgia was completely in the spotlight after 2020. There's also been sort of certain ructions about the state election board and about sort of, you know, how the election is going to be organized here, especially if the election is close. How important conceivably could all that be?
Well, it could be very important, and you know, people don't want to talk about election mechanics, you know, actually holding an election and all that entails, but it's critically important. It's important that voters, however they vote, have confidence in the election system, period, that the state can deliver a final vote tally quickly. Since 2020, the state legislature has taken measures to ensure that things like the vote tally can get pushed up and can get delivered much quicker, which induces, you know, confidence amongst the electorate and the election machinery.
Trey Hood, Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia, talking there to NewsHour's Tim Franks. Now, one of the quirks of Oregon in America's Pacific Northwest is that it's home to a pretty sizable number of what are known as preppers or survivalists. It doesn't take long to find internet groups in the state with hundreds of members who are devoted to prepping or preparing for some kind of emergency. For some, at the most extreme end, that's the threat of US federal forces coming to take your land and arming yourself accordingly. For others, it's preparing for a natural calamity.
It's a beautiful day today in Portland. The sun is shining, not too much wind, blue sky, everything seems very peaceful. But I'm with a man who's worried about what might happen in the future in this area. Marcel Rodriguez, we're on your deck,
yep,
in your backyard. What are you worried about?
The big worry is a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake.
They've well, had, what does that mean, first
well,
of
yeah,
all?
Well, yeah, so traditionally, approximately every 300 years, there has been a very large earthquake, about a magnitude 9+, in a fault off of the coast of Oregon that runs basically all the way from British Columbia all the way down to around the California border. And we know that the last one happened in 1700 because of records from Japan, as well as some records that we have locally from geological stuff. And so we're currently sitting at year 324 for an event that happens approximately every 300 years.
And if that did happen, what would that look like for Portland?
Bad day, really bad day. It would mean region-wide destruction, Washington, Oregon, and parts of California, pretty much most of the infrastructure gone, as well as, you know, the hospitals, the power, communications, all of that, pretty much either severely compromised or completely gone. For months.
Now, you're a trainer with the Neighborhood Emergency Team. So how do you prepare for something so catastrophic? What are you telling people in your neighborhood that they should be doing?
It's really about just preparedness in general. The first sort of step that we look at is, can you be sufficient for 72 hours? Do you have enough food? Do you have enough water? Do you have, you know, the medicines that you need? Do you have a way to keep your house warm if you lose power and lose your heat like we did this winter when we had giant ice storms?
Do you have all that in place?
Yeah, we have drinking water and we have water filters that we can use. We also have a generator, run it off of propane, so we have enough propane to get us through probably a week. Really just basic things. So we think about, like, what would we grab if something happened? Where would we go? Do we have phone numbers?
What would you do? I mean, if your house suffered a lot of damage? Have you got a sort of tent that you could sleep in for a few days?
Yeah, I have a truck that has a camper on it that's basically always got about 2 weeks' worth of food and supplies in it. Whatever, if we need to set up a field medical point, you know, we practice things like that with the neighborhood emergency teams.
It's not, of course, just the potential for a big earthquake here, which may not happen in your lifetime, but as you were alluding to, I mean, there were big storms here this winter. With climate change, presumably, there's the risk of flooding, perhaps, in low-lying areas of Portland. I mean, is that on your mind as well?
Sure. So when we had things like we lost power for a few days when it was sub-zero temperatures, some of our neighbors were out of power for weeks. You know, just, and
that's, said the trees were falling down on houses.
We had trees falling down, houses right within where we can see, you know, were destroyed and had to be rebuilt. But we also have recently had wildfires, multiple years. We've had wildfires that were so bad we had to shelter in place because the air was so bad.
So it's not paranoia?
No. These are real things that happen.
So are you a prepper? Is that a dirty word now?
I wouldn't say that it's a dirty word. It's a loaded word.
There are some hardcore preppers in the state, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing is it sort of sometimes comes down to what event you feel that you're planning for. And for me personally, I think, you know, we plan for a wide variety of natural or man-made disasters.
What about if there were civil unrest, for example, in the wake of a disputed election? Does that keep you awake at night?
I mean, yes or no. We've had that. I mean, like, we literally had that. To me, that's the same philosophy that I would apply to any situation, which is this a shelter-in-place situation or is this an evacuation situation?
Marcel Rodriguez in Portland, Oregon. So where does all this leave us now? The BBC's North America correspondent, Anthony Zerker, joins me now from Michigan. And Anthony, very good to have you with us. We heard earlier from some Midwestern voters. Why is the Midwest so important in this election?
Well, the Midwest has a number of key electoral battlegrounds. These are states that have a lot of electoral votes, which is what matters in a presidential election. And they are narrowly divided, closely contested by both the Republicans and the Democrats. If you think back to 2016, it was three Midwestern states in particular, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, that Donald Trump won. They had traditionally been carried by Democrats, but because Donald Trump won them, they essentially delivered the White House to Donald Trump. And it was Joe Biden in 2020 winning those states back, narrowly, but winning them back, that led to the defeat of Donald Trump. So it's a part of the country, a region of the country, that has politics that are up for grabs.
And is that why both presidential candidates picked Midwesterners as their running mates, Tim Walz and J.D. Vance? And did they think that they would definitely help perhaps swing some of those states?
Well, every little bit matters. And J.D. Vance is from Ohio and Tim Walz is from Minnesota. Those aren't the key battlegrounds that I mentioned, but they both are able to talk to the concerns of Midwesterners, and they have an appeal to Midwesterners. At least that's what both parties, both presidential nominees, hoped when they picked them. J.D. Vance obviously focuses a lot on the concerns of the white working class, the industrial working class in the Midwest. And Tim Walz was perceived to be, as governor of Minnesota, someone who could speak to the concerns of Midwesterners, who was maybe a little more conservative culturally, but was able to package progressive liberal policies in a way that would appeal to Midwestern voters. So, yeah, there's a strategy behind both of those. And of course, both campaigns have those vice presidential candidates, as well as the top of the ticket, making repeated appearances in all of these states.
You hinted at the importance of turnout, parties getting their supporters to turn out. Is that what this election is going to turn on, do you think?
Yeah, when you look at the polls, I mean, the number of undecided voters, the people who are truly up for grabs, it's a small universe. You know, you're fighting over just fractions of a percent of the vote. So I think both campaigns are much more conscious that their time is best spent trying to get people who support them to actually cast ballots. I mean, if you look at what the Trump campaign is doing in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, they're trying to identify people who would vote for Trump, who are much more likely to vote for Trump, but just don't vote. They don't show up very, very often. If they can get those people to turn out and cast ballots, then they think they're going to be able to turn this race on its head. The Harris campaign, I think, is focusing a lot on young voters who also are not as likely to vote. I was just in Pittsburgh a couple days ago and seeing the college campuses around Pittsburgh and the efforts that the Harris campaign is making to register voters on those college campuses to get them enthused and to get them to turn out. I think that is another big focus for that campaign. And honestly, a difference from what we were seeing with Joe Biden, where youth interest, youth activism, youth engagement was much, much lower. Turnout, I think, when it comes down to it, turnout is key. Convincing undecided voters, while important, is not the best use of their resources in their evaluation.
If it is really tight, are there going to be a lot of disputes about the result? I mean, might there be another January the 6th?
I think we're already seeing Donald Trump and Republicans call into question the validity of the voting. I don't think we're going to see something like January 6th, at least not in Washington, D.C. The security presence, I'm certain, in Washington, D.C. is going to be much, much higher. If you're looking for a place where there's weakness, where there's a sign that there could be disruptions and even violence, look at the states and look at individual states that are these key battlegrounds and what happens during the vote counting after the election and in the state level certification, because there's just much less preparation in those areas for what could turn to be disruptive violence.
Just finally, gaze into your crystal ball. I mean, what do you think the rest of the campaign holds, has in store? I mean, it sort of feels like things have settled down into a bit of a pattern, but I guess, I mean, anything can happen, can't it?
Anything can happen. The one thing to remember, looking at this race and all of the twists and turns we've had so far, all of the unprecedented developments we've had, whether it's indictments and convictions or replacements of the nominee, it really hasn't changed the fundamental dynamics of this race. And that is that this is a very, very tight presidential campaign. The United States is divided into two camps, and they're two very evenly matched camps. So this election is probably going to hang on a knife's edge all the way up to Election Day.
The BBC's North America correspondent, Anthony Zerker. Well, that's all we have for now. But NewsHour will, of course, continue to follow the US election closely over the next 40 days and indeed afterwards. Thank you for downloading this special bonus edition of the NewsHour podcast. If you're not already, do subscribe to the feed so you'll receive future episodes of NewsHour and bonus content like this as soon as it's available. Bye-bye.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.